When we talk about inclusion, when we talk about belonging, it takes the whole legal community, right? That means there's a role that faculty plays. There's a role that staff plays. And there's a role that fellow students, fellow peers play in a culture and environment where folks can feel at least included in belonging and that they can express themselves, a space where they can learn and make mistakes and grow.
Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Max Gaston. For those of you who are longtime listeners, the podcast has recently undergone some changes, and you can now find us everywhere as the Welcome Table Podcast, where we still cover all of the issues in law, culture, society, and business that matter to all of us. My guest for today is Elizabeth Bodmer, Director of Research Strategy at the Law School Admissions Council. Liz brings a wealth of expertise and insight into the evolving landscape of legal education. Her leadership at LSAC has been instrumental in shaping critical research that highlights the experiences and challenges of aspiring law students. Today, we're going to dive into LSAC's recently published 2024 Knowledge Report, which offers a comprehensive look at the 2023-2024 cohort of test takers. The report is especially timely given the major shifts in law school admissions, including recent orders by the federal government and the Supreme Court's recent ruling on affirmative action. From early aspirations and the motivations driving law school candidates, to barriers like cost of attendance and the sense of belonging or lack thereof, the report paints a compelling picture of the future of legal education overall. Liz and I will talk together about the big picture themes, explore the nuanced findings, and unpack what law schools can do to better serve the next generation of legal leaders. Here is my conversation with Elizabeth Bodmer. Liz, welcome to the Welcome Table.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's go ahead and dive right into this. Tell me what the inspiration was behind putting together this report, and what does the data tell us about this cohort of students from the 2023 and 2024 cycle?
All right, so it's LSAC's mission to advance law and justice by promoting access, equity, and fairness in law school admission, but also along the learning journey from pre-law through practice. A part of this is understanding who is coming through or not coming through, but it's also about what are they thinking, feeling, doing, and experiencing. And so when I think about this first report of many to come, outside of my very own journey, I actually think about a candidate I met a couple of years ago. So I used to table for LSAC's forum. For those of you who don't know what the forums are, think of them as the law fair to attend, right? All these law schools come in, it gets packed with all these students interested in law school, and they're asking tons of questions. So at the end of the day, and it's a very, very long day for those of us who work it, right? That year, I think I spoke to about 200 prospective candidates. And so people were slowly packing up. Everyone's exhausted. They kind of had lunch or they kind of didn't. And then this student appears in the doorway to the resource center, which is where we're all tabled. And so she stops at each table along the way so she can talk to like a pre-law advisor, financial aid person, so on and so forth. And then she gets to us. She looks so tired. And she whispers, she goes, "Can I just sit down?" And we're like, "Of course," right? And she just falls in this chair. And as she's doing that, she places a massive backpack she was carrying on the table. And this massive, one of those like gallon-sized water bottles, they're just right in front of her. And she just flops down. She's done. She is exhausted. She exhales. And I look at her and I'm like, "All right, what do you need?" She goes, "Just tell me what I need to know." And so we just get, talking. We're talking about her mainly. And she's a new mom. And she had taken a 6-hour train ride to be here.
Wow.
To talk to admission officers and to learn everything she could because she had this dream. She wanted to go to law school. And we were her last table, her last conversation before she left to catch last train of the day to go home to her baby.
Wow.
I think about her often and that long journey she took. So Max, behind every data point is a story. It's a person. And so in our research, it's not just about understanding what this journey is like for individuals and communities. It's about amplifying their voices to inform how can we improve the way we support and guide the next generation. So the data in this particular report serves as like a pulse check, right, of who's coming through, their stories, their goals, motivations, barriers that they are painfully aware of, right, and their anticipation, off of which can help law school admission offices learn to better recruit, can help law schools better retain students, right? Efforts in law school recruitment and retention have been going for decades before the Supreme Court decision last year. And so we hope that this data and any future data we are currently collecting can help drive and fortify and support these efforts and any new ones to come.
That's such an interesting picture that you paint of this student who comes in totally exhausted and just needs to know what they need to do in order to get there. It reminds me of, when we're lawyers and we're going through this back when we were law students, coming to the LSAC forum and really just in some ways being a deer in headlights, not even knowing the things that you don't know. And it's such an uphill climb for some people to get there in the first place. And that's only one of what, a million steps that you have to take in order to actually get into law school. Then you've got to make it through law school, then you have to take the bar exam, and you have to find a job. And it's just a really hard journey to take, especially when you don't know, you can't really navigate the terrain. And so we were talking about this a little bit offline. Sometimes for students who come in with backgrounds, maybe they're first generation or they don't have any experiences with the legal profession, it can feel like they're walking blindly. What do you think this report tells us about the 2023-2024 cohort, generally speaking?
A part of the work we're doing and a little bit of the history that I've seen is the 2023-2024 test taker cohort is telling us something that has been true for a lot of years, I want to say, right? Which is, first and foremost, people are going to law school to do good, right? And there are assumptions made about when people first think about it, why they do what they do, right? I've heard all kinds of things. They're doing it for the money, right? And when you ask them, it's not about the money, right? It comes down to their experience, right? What makes a person want to take up something, go down a path they've never been for been before? They know no one who's been down that path, and they're like, I'm going to go for it, right? Because they know that on the other side, they can come back and have that kind of an impact. And the 23-24 test taker cohort that this report's based off of, I think, is both a reminder of why people have been coming through, especially students from marginalized communities, and what really drives them. It continues to drive them. And it's a continual reminder of why we need to continue to support students along the way, especially those who don't have access to the resources, the opportunity to get there to begin with.
Yeah, you mentioned the path to law school. And one of the things that you talk about in the report is that a lot of test takers, especially Black students, start thinking about law school as early as elementary school, which was something that was not completely surprising to me, but I guess, just hearing it is like, oh yeah, I guess that's true, because, self-included, you do think about it early on. What does the early ambition to pursue a career in law tell us about the untapped potential in marginalized communities, and how should schools respond to that early interest that a lot of students have?
So that really stood out to me too. And a little teaser, the same insight about early thinking about law school early on is echoed almost exactly of the 2023 1L survey respondents, so it's consistent throughout. But what this particular data point is telling me, why it sticks out, is that I think it's the underlying assumption that many people hold about access to legal education and law. All right, there is this assumption that there is an underrepresentation of marginalized communities in the profession because people are just like not exposed to the possibility of the legal career early enough. Then you have this answer of, well, it has to do with exposure. You just have to expose them, a one day session of, here you go, law is a career, it's an opportunity, you can do this, right? But this finding that one in four Black test takers reported they first thought about law school in elementary school tells us that exposure alone is not key here, right? The majority of prospective applicants are thinking about this long before college. Most of them are thinking about it as, as children. Now, whether that exposure leads to that, the exposure that leads to this aspiration was positive or negative, that's unknown. However, what is really, really telling is that inequality is a result of intentional systematic barriers, which then requires on our end, right, knowing that folks are thinking about law school as early as elementary school, it requires that on our end an intentional and systematic approach to supporting aspiring students and lawyers throughout that journey, right? Especially when they're coming from marginalized community. This means building opportunities that cultivate and turn this aspiration, this nugget, right, into reality. So how can programs that expose children to the possibility of law work with other programs or schools to then help those same children build the academic skills they need and provide them with the resources from that point moving forward? So for schools, this means being intentional on what they build and what they do, right? How are you investing your time in the community, and how are they collaborating with pathway programs in an effective way where they can impact that pivotal points in time to provide those resources, to provide those opportunity, that knowledge, right, as they're doing this community outreach?
Do you notice a gap at all in the level of resources that are available to folks who are interested from that early on stage? So, people who want to be a lawyer their entire lives, is there any difference in what you're seeing as far as the support they receive to help them get there? Because I do think you hear it from both sides, whether they're first generation folks or folks who have multiple generations of attorneys in their families. I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer, but I think that sometimes the resources that are available to them and some of what you're talking about of what we need to create is because those resources are not sort of broadly spread out across that population of people who knew so early on that they wanted to go to law school.
Yeah, there is absolutely a gap. So when we think about it, inequality starts long before someone submits their very first application to law school, right? Access to resources and learning opportunities are not equal for all. So when we think about, let's go with early education, it's often poorly resourced in marginalized community, right? And that limits opportunities for students to develop the skills they need to succeed in college, and then from college, right, through the law school admission process and through law school and beyond. So it's well established that where you live and learn impacts our life outcomes, right? It impacts a number of areas like, your educational preparation and attainment, or the opportunity to actually demonstrate non-academic factors and personal qualities, to have those opportunities to show leadership and to do extracurricular engagement, right? It impacts even the social support, as you were describing, the social support system necessary to navigate like a very complex and expensive, quite frankly, educational system to prepare oneself to really stand out, right? So it's not simply about encouragement. That's where I'm getting to here, is that aspiring students are committed, some of which are exemplified in that story I told you, who took the 6-hour train ride, right? You see it, and it's about intervening along their journey to provide the opportunities for skills development. It's about intervening to provide that guidance. It's about intervening to provide that focused resources when they need it, at the time they need it, because it comes full circle, the education system in this country is so unequal. right? So there are many programs across this country that do this. Examples include Street Law. We have CLEO. We have the AILC PLSI. And then we also have our very own PLUS program, right? To just name a few national programs, right? Pathway programs here, right, are absolutely pivotal because they reach out at different points in time on the journey and addressing that gap that we're talking about.
Yeah, when we were talking about this earlier, you were describing it as running a race, maybe a 5K or a marathon with different, stopping spaces, and not everyone necessarily has all of the equipment to make it through the race or to have a map to know how to get from start to finish in the same way. And so really what we're talking about here, and I think what you're saying is pathway programs, opportunities to access students earlier and earlier, is a way for us to create that scaffolding and to create that support so that all of the students who come in with an early desire are able to meet that desire if that's what they want to do.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to get a little personal here. When I think about my journey and how I got where I got, right? Neither of my parents have an education, period. And so I like to tell folks, I'm first gen everything. And when I think about the role that pathway programs in my life, it's massive. I went from doing the TRIO Upward Bound program because no one knew how to apply to college or what it was all about, right? I did the PLUS program. I did a state iCLEO program to transition into law school. These stops are like those water stops, right? Because it gives me a sense of, all right, I'm going to in the right direction. All right, I need to turn left over up ahead. But as you said, some folks don't have a map. Some folks don't have running shoes, right? And so how do we position these different programs along the way, and how do we connect them is what's key here.
Yeah, creating a water stop along the way so that folks can have a moment to kind of catch their breath and take stock so that they're not so disoriented with a very overwhelming process in the first place. I want to talk about the why behind why a lot of students choose to go to law school, students from underrepresented backgrounds and students generally. One of the things that the report shows is that a lot of students are driven by a desire to advocate for social justice. And to uplift their own communities. And so I was just wondering if you could talk about that piece of data from the report and, maybe explain in your perspective how law schools can really position themselves in order to respond to that really rich desire, which I suspect will only grow as we, move into more divisive times in our world.
Yeah, so we found the top three most often ranked motivations, were one, being helpful to others, two, advocating for social justice, and three, developing valuable skills. And then we took a deeper dive and we find that about 40% of our Black, Latinx, Middle Eastern, North African, and American Indian, Alaska Native respondents reported advocating for social justice and uplifting their community as their top motivation for going to law school, right? So law school here, right? Using these insights, they can use it to set their recruitment strategies around course offerings, experiential opportunities that their law schools can provide that speak to, right, the aspiring law student's unique why, right? Tailored recruiting strategies will then send a resounding message, right, to prospective applicants that law schools care about their why. Right, why they're coming here, and they can provide them with the resources to help develop the particular skill sets they need to achieve their goals. But additionally, what's kind of interesting when we were drafting up this report that really came out was that these insights are also important for the application process, right? And specifically the optional or additional essays, right? Encouraging law school applicants to speak to their why as motivating factors can be a powerful way of promoting inclusion, right? So if a law school has a goal of increasing access to justice, let's say, then having one and essays that help identify community connection and drive, having students even do that reflection, right? And two, having programs or courses that assist then law students and giving back or returning to their community. With those two things, right, they serve as motivators to applicants and actual positive tools for change that schools can concretely teach their students. So one of the many things that happens in that very first year of law school, I don't know if you can remember it, I tried to block it out every once in a while, right, is how much we are pulled away from our why and our humanity, right? We get busy reading cases, briefing, outlining, feeling that pressure, right, to perform.
Trying to pass civil procedure and property.
Right? Trying to see if you can get by the day without being cold called, right? But at the core, right, of social justice, at the core of uplifting community, at the core of doing good as law school motivators, at the end of the day, is that human experience. So people are motivated by their own experiences and the experiences of their loved ones. So how can law schools foster a space where faculty can be innovative in how they teach law grounded in the human experience? How do law schools create more experiential opportunities where students can have hands-on experience touching someone's life, right? It's one thing to learn about the naturalization process in immigration class, which is probably the boring part of it, right? It's another thing when you help someone fill out the application and that pure joy on their faces at the oath ceremony. Two different experiences.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, really speaking to the piece of it where if this is a value of the law school, if this is a mission that they have, really trying to make sure that they're living by that mission by providing those opportunities for students to engage. It's interesting to me because I think that sometimes law schools feel the pressure of needing to rise in the rankings or maintain a ranking, and so they'll look after some of the priorities that will support that, you know. Big law firm placements and, you know, clerkship opportunities. And these things are great things too. They're not to say that those are not valuable and students shouldn't want to consider those. But I'm just wondering, do you feel like there is maybe a disconnect between the messaging from law schools or the resources that law schools provide to that community of students who are saying we care about and we value social justice and that's why we came to law school?
I think there's an issue of framing or reframing, right? So what is clear in this report and even in the data that's coming through right now, people see law as a vehicle for change. They see it as a vehicle for justice. They see it as a vehicle for a better life, right? So it's not simply about whether a school is aligned with a student's social justice set of goals, right? But whether they can meet them where they are to effectively teach them the skills and the tools they need in the profession. So not every incoming law student motivated to do, you know, social justice advocacy work will end up in public interest, for example. Some will end up falling in love with corporations and end up in big law, but they can still advocate for social justice and their pro bono work, right? And how they give back to their communities. And so the drive for social justice and for doing good can be a way law schools can use to rethink and for a way for faculty to rethink how they teach law, how they teach these skills, how they teach critical thinking, tying back to a little bit of that experiential learning, but also rethinking the, you know, usual black letter law in a vacuum kind of approach.
I also want to talk to you about the financial barriers to accessing a legal education. I think you mentioned it before, just kind of how expensive it is to go to law school, and it's only getting more and more expensive. I remember when I was a student applying to law school thinking, how am I going to pay for this? And the prices have only risen, you know, since then. Do you think that there are any particular solutions or strategies that schools should approach when they're considering how to make law school more accessible for students, in particular students who do come from low-income backgrounds, first-generation backgrounds, who might have a harder time financing the pursuit?
That's a good question. So cost is a major barrier for prospective applicants based on access to resources, right? So let's kind of dive into an example. 24%, so about one in four first-generation college graduates listed not receiving financial aid as the top factor that would prevent them from attending law school. Now, compare that to only 16% of their continuing generation peers. That's about a 50% higher rate, right? So at the undergraduate level, we see several schools covering tuition for students from homes that make less than a certain amount, right? In legal education, scholarship allocation around public interest and other focused areas of practice tied with an internship program have existed. So we'll see if those even expand, but they may not, right? For a number of reasons. Other schools I've noticed are refocusing their fundraising efforts to see if they can fund need-based scholarships. However, it's harder in law school, right? Given the availability of federal loans and how scholarships are leveraged, quite frankly, in admissions and in recruitment. So in the end, I think it will take really a collective effort to really address the cost barrier, especially for first generation graduates and students coming from communities that are law deserts, right? Like, so for example, we have Equal Justice Works, who does an amazing job here, right? Providing program opportunities to law students and law graduates. And so how do you marry both, their need for aid and their drive to give back or return to their communities? And so it's going to be really about, if we want to see a change in like cost structure or how to fund students, it's going to take a collective effort. It's going to take how firms and programs and other stakeholders will partner up with schools to create the financial and skill-based opportunities for students, right? Especially students with less access to financial support. However, really frankly, I'm not sure if there will be any changes coming to impact the affordability of law school anytime soon, but we'll see, right? We can be pleasantly surprised, given how it's structured and how it's working.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think it's one that we get a lot on the road when we're talking to students. And I always try to, I love what you were saying about sort of this intersectional approach to responding to the problem of financing your education, because I do think it's going to take a lot of different groups and people. You know, it takes a village. And what I say to students when we're talking on the road is, I want you to think about your finances and your experience in three stages, at the very least three stages. You know, when you're starting and you're saying, well, what is this going to cost me? So, what am I receiving in the way of scholarships, student loans, that sort of thing? Then, the actual life cycle of your being a law student. What are the resources available within the institution to support you financially in moments where you really need help and support? Not just jobs, but if you find yourself in an emergency, is there a way for the school to support you? Some schools do have those opportunities, you know, and that's something to ask about when you come to a table and wanting to know, well, what resources are there available within student services or within your financial aid department? And then the third piece of it to me is, after law school, how do you pay down your debt? Because the vast majority of people who go to law school come out with debt. And so if you are social justice minded, if you are public interest minded, does the school offer a loan or a payment assistance program? You know, are there ways to support you subsidizing the cost of the debt that you took out in order to continue down a path that speaks to why you went to law school in the first place? And so I think all of those pieces, you know, some of that is the federal government, some of that is private loans, some of that is, like you were saying, EJW, some of that is the institution itself. And so, really, everyone kind of working together, I think if we could all appreciate that there is an issue here and there's a greater need for access, then we can start to explore more collaborative solutions. But for the student perspective, I think at the very least, what they can do is ask those critical questions. And I think it's hard when you don't know what you don't know, but you know, listening to people like you who have a perspective on this and kind of getting a sense of the questions that they should be asking, or even asking at a table, what don't I know about financially that I should be knowing about and I should probably take with me to other tables? Equipping themselves with that knowledge of how to at least start that conversation and pick up new information is a great starting point, I think, for students.
Absolutely. I love the part, and that's a big lesson that I learned after the fact, right? Of not just thinking about how, paying for law school and in that moment, like your next 3 years, 4 years, 4 years, depending on the program you're in, right? But what does life look like afterwards? And so there's, for a lot of students, I've seen, they'll start school and then they'll have their first, financial aid kind of related session where they start to think about repayment plans and all of that. And it's the first time they're thinking about how will this impact how whether or not I can buy a home, right? That's the first time they think about it, right? And so, having that conversation of not just, how are you going to finance this, and there are multiple ways to do it, but how, those multiple ways, will that impact life afterwards, and how do you plan for that, right? And that's a hard one, especially for students who have families that really rely on them even during law school, right? And so that's something they have to plan out in advance, but it comes down to asking the questions. Then it comes down to who's out there doing this really good work to do this outreach to educate.
Liz, I want to talk a bit about belonging and inclusivity. And one of the things that I thought was really striking in the report was the finding that while a lot of students believe that that belonging is important, they don't necessarily know that they will experience belonging in law school. And so that feeling of I won't be valued or fully accepted, that's something I think maybe a lot of us experience, whether or not we choose to say it out loud, regardless of whether you are first gen in a minority or in a majority group. What should law schools be doing beyond talking about inclusivity to create environments where all students not only belong, but are able to thrive?
Yeah, that's a great question. given how ingrained and stiff law school culture feels like, right? So we, what we find is long before potentially, right? Long before potentially becoming law students and actually experiencing that law school environment and culture, our respondents indicated, yep. I belong here. People like me belong here in this in law school, right? The vast majority, when I say vast majority, we're talking about 85% or more, right? Reported that they belong in law school and that law school is a realistic option. But then we see that drop, right? That you're noting here is when they were asked about being valued. And that's where we see about 3 out of 10 respondents anticipated that they would not be valued in law school. And so when we zoomed in a little bit more into who those folks were, right, we got an understanding that nearly double the proportion of respondents who identify as Black, Latinx, American Indian, or Alaskan Native strongly disagreed or disagreed that people like them are valued in law school. Now you compare that to their white peers. And so these particular insights provide evidence that belonging in legal education is not simply about that individual student, right? And as you're getting to, right, it's also about how they'll experience it or how they think they will experience it. So whether or not they are valued. So creating a culture and environment that is inclusive, where everyone feels a sense of belonging, is not created with, these one-liners. Sometimes it's a faculty member, or sometimes it's a dean, right? With really good intentions on orientation day, they keep reiterating, you belong. It might even turn into a hashtag after a while, right? Right? It takes time. It's intentional, hard conversation. It's about rethinking how you teach a case. It's or how do you address that most of the defendants in your crim law class are from marginalized groups, or how do you facilitate a class discussion where different perspectives are included and respected, right? So Dr. Miradeo has this really great paper that just came out this month titled Building Belonging. You can do a quick little Google search, it'll take you right straight to it. I highly recommend it to schools and others. She does a great job looking into how law schools can build belonging to impact retention. And why is that important? Because ABA 509 data shows us that we see the highest attrition rate in that first year, and Black and Latinx 1Ls are overrepresented in stopping out of law school. So her argument, and I agree with it, right, is that at the end of the day, it's going to take, and it goes back, I think, to this like echoing theme here. It takes a village, but it really, when we talk about inclusion, when we talk about belonging, it takes the whole legal community, right? That means there's a role that faculty plays, there's a role that staff plays, and there's a role that fellow students, fellow peers play in a culture and environment where folks can feel at least included in belonging, and that they can express themselves, a space where they can learn and make mistakes and grow.
I love everything that you're saying, and the that unique sort of carve out the distinction between belonging and value, I think is so powerful because it just adds a new lens to how we look at the meaning of those words. For me, it makes me think, okay, so when a student says, I belong here, I wonder how much of that is coming from an internal sense of, you're not going to tell me that I don't belong in law school, okay? I worked hard to get here. I'm here. I belong. As opposed to how it is, whether that's coming from the external messages that they're receiving, you know, because where belonging and value depart from one another, what it tells me is you have a sense of belonging and you have a strong conviction for where you're going to go and what you are called to do, but you appreciate that maybe not everyone else sees you that way, and so that makes you then call into question your value in that space. And I don't know that people oftentimes look at it that way. You know, the folks who are maybe the onlookers on the student who might, you know, lead to the impact of the student feeling that they're not valued. I don't know that people in the institution necessarily see themselves doing it that way. And so you were kind of talking a bit more about what schools can do, but I'm wondering if you could expand on that and really give some perspective on how do we make people feel valued. And how do we maybe change our own perspectives on people so that they are, you know, so that we are, we're coming with a genuine belief that they do belong here and we want to value that.
Oh, absolutely. So what I get from the students, from the respondents is this resounding, pounding at the door of we want tangible demonstration that others know that they belong there too, right? That others want them there too, right? And for schools, this is about how their program is structured. It's about the opportunities they provide. It's about the type of career, academic, and personal support they provide, right? It's about faculty's commitment to teaching, right? And, I think some of us have experience where, faculty members like, well, they need to teach themselves, right? And we have to remember that law students are exactly that. They're students, right? And so, how do you demonstrate that faculty are committed to teaching, right? They want that transparency. When they're out and when law schools are recruiting, what's one very transparent way of doing it is connecting prospective applicants to actual students who can tell them and be candid about what the experience is like. Because when I think about, right, going off of this conversation of belonging and value, depending on who you ask, right, it can be this internal personal, like, yeah, I belong here. This is my chair. People like me deserve to be here. I deserve to be here, right? But then there's also the belonging, the actual actualized belonging that isn't a result of the law school structure. It isn't a result of the institution. It is a result of the work the student themselves have put in to carve out their own space, right? That's where the roles of student organizations come into play, right? Where they find that space, that corner, that couch, that table where they can be themselves to continue on, right? There's that aspect. And so schools can definitely play a larger role in how they are creating that kind of environment. How are they facilitating that kind of engagement between students, where students don't have to feel like they have to carve out their own role.
Yeah, because it really creates this tension between the student themselves and their sense of belonging and what they meet with other people. And I think that's where, you know, the social or the colloquial term imposter syndrome comes from. You know, the idea of it's maybe not even just that you don't value me, but you don't have that many high expectations for me in this space. You know, you don't know that I'm going to be successful here, and you question that. And so there's a tension that exists, I think, sometimes between that internal self sense of self and conviction and what the messages are that you're receiving from other people, whether they're explicit messages or subliminal messages, you know, telling you that this isn't your space, you can't succeed here, and you are not going to succeed. And it's interesting the correlation or the point that you were raising before about attrition and the identities of the folks that leave. And I wonder how much of that is related to the messages that we receive. You know, we did a podcast episode a couple of years ago with with Dr. Kevin Coakley, who researches the imposter phenomenon in higher education for folks from marginalized communities. And he talks about how these messages that we receive from the earliest stages are the things that will then inform how we see ourselves and how we are kind of able to rise and thrive in a space. And part of it can create a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. When you have that sense of imposterism because you don't believe that people around you think that you are going to succeed, there are times where you fall to meet that standard of kind of expectation. You know, you perform at the level that they believe that you're going to perform at because you're kind of living into the feeling or the perception of those around you for how successful you can be, how capable you can be. And it's really fascinating to think about how limiting beliefs that other people have about us can then kind of inform our own behavior. How do you think schools respond to this problem? Because I can very easily see faculty, for instance, wanting to support their students, but nevertheless, you know, having their own biases slip through where they say unintentionally something that just reveals they don't actually think a student is particularly capable.
This is great. It also gets me super excited. So there's a lot of work, upcoming work, on this. So I know that Dr. Mary Murphy has done a lot of work around this, but I kept, you know, listening to you, I kept hearing about, or at least in my head, I kept hearing institutional mindset, right? I kept hearing a culture of growth, and that it's not just the messages we're getting from individuals, but also what are we getting from the institutions. You know, some of those old school sayings like look to your right, look to your left, you know, one of you is not going to be here right at the end. It's a very fixed mindset. Like people are incapable of growing, right? And so, you know, law school can be challenging. It is challenging. And that needs to be normalized, right? Getting questions wrong in class is a part of the learning process. It is not a reflection of a person's worth or worthiness for that seat that they occupy, right? And I think that's what this report kind of gets to, is also this push of it's not just the individual level, right? Schools need to start thinking about it at an institutional level. The message you're sending as you're supporting faculty, as you're, you know, creating the curriculum, as you set the standards of how do you support growth for students, right? There's a need for inclusive pedagogy. Most of our faculty members aren't taught to teach, right? And that's something we have to remember, is that a lot of our faculty members went to law school to be lawyers, right? And so, like, there is, like, let's be real, there's a need for inclusive pedagogy, inclusive classroom practices, right? There's always going to be, you know, be this robust, you know, network of support that you can find in student-facing offices. Are schools investing in that for the purpose of wanting to support their students, not for the purpose or for the factors that matter for rankings, right? Although they both, you know, they kind of fill into each other. And then, you know, it's about providing and learning how to provide students with powerful learning opportunities where they engage and learn from peers that are different from them in productive ways. And not many law schools know how to do that, right? And of course, law, you know, student organizations, like I said, play a major role in fostering that kind of a space, and how schools invest in those organizations echoes the support they provide those students, right? And so it really comes down to this, as Dr. Mary Murphy in one of her latest books is talking about, which is the culture of growth. How do you cultivate a culture of growth at the law school level, right? That then comes down all the way down to the students, where they know they don't have to be afraid of cold calling because you're the only Black student in the room, or you're the only Latina in the room. And if you get it wrong, there it goes, right? And the murmurs start going. Getting something wrong is okay. It's part of learning and it's part of growing. And so, how do you foster an environment that makes that safe and okay? And that's something I think law schools really struggle with because of this set standard of culture that it has to be, quote unquote, rigorous, right? And for some reason, that means being a vacuum and being cold.
I feel like what we're really talking about is sustainable institutional transformation. You know, how do we transform the institution from top to bottom, you know, back to front? And I think that when we're thinking about it this way, it reminds me of just an ecosystem. You know, how you have to sort of cater to every piece of an ecosystem in order for the whole to thrive. If you neglect any one piece of it, then the collective suffers. And to your point about faculty and how faculty come in, they came from law school, they were trained to be lawyers. It's not like doing a PhD program where you have a stint where you're teaching. And then sometimes, even when they do come in as professors, they're coming into these huge law schools that are also research institutions. They're coming in to publish. They're not necessarily looking at it as teaching is going to be the focus of my time and energy, nor is going to be managing administrative staff or any of the other pieces of this that are, you know, functioning as the role outside of the faculty piece of it. And so you can't just say, here's the faculty, here's the staff, here are the other parts of the community. Let's just ignore those and let's focus on the students. Because all of those other pieces of the ecosystem inform the ultimate experience of the student, whether you are challenging your biases, you know, because the faculty themselves are the ones that the students will look up to and they will model after that behavior. And a faculty's perspective on something will either, you know, kind of check students or embolden them to behave badly. And so I think there's a real need when we look at institutional transformation in the way that you're describing to address every piece of our community and find ways to equip all of us, not for the necessarily individualized goal of just like, let's just make faculty better for the sake of faculty, or let's make staff better for their own sakes. But if we all want to align around the mission of supporting students, we have to do something for ourselves to equip ourselves in a better way. I just, it's just such a holistic approach that I think is oftentimes, for efficiency purposes, lacking in the way that we pursue this goal of bringing in, you know, more people under the big umbrella of legal education.
It is, and I and a part of it, I think, also has to do with the fact that in the equation, I think what we're not talking about is the human part of it. There are feelings, there are big feelings, there are emotions, there are all kinds of things, right, related to this. And so kind of taking it down to that human element is what makes it hard, and it requires intentionality. But there's a quote in Dr. Mirabeau's article that really, I think, sums up what's happening here, and if we can distill it down to the ground, is belonging is a function of relationships. Thus, every interaction, right? Every interaction can contribute in either positive or negative ways, right? And so when we think about institutional transformation, right, we're really thinking about how do we cultivate, grow, help people learn how to have functional, productive relationships with each other. Right? How can they be there for each other? How can they teach? Right? And so, law school can be this super, super high pressure environment. Like, it's felt by everyone. Students feel it in particular, let's be honest, right? But it really comes down, when we think about transformation, comes down to that human level. So I worked at Student Affairs at a law school, and it always comes down to that. There's always a story, right? Law students are, like I said before, they're exactly that. They're students. They're going to mess up. They're learning. It is our job. And when I say our job, I'm meaning it's staff, it's faculty, it's the administration, right? And but it's also the students. It's our job individually and collectively to reach them where they are, to build them, right? Be it their writing skills, being their critical thinking skills, be it their emotional intelligence, right? Because this is a combination of, classroom time, office hours, out of class programming, experiential learning, personal support, you name it, that holistic experience. The experience isn't just isolated to the classroom. And so when I think about, that transformative experience and what gets you through it, what gets students through it, I think about the school where I went, and also I worked there. We had this first year mentor-like program that all first year law students did, right? And so what happened was, if you're rising 2L or 3L, you would interview to become a peer mentor. There was a process in place. You were trained the summer before, and you were assigned a group of first year law students. right? And you would meet with them on the regular basis, weekly, and you were required to meet with faculty, and faculty got to engage and humanize and get to know their students on a personal level. And that same way, the students got to know the faculty member at a personal level, right? Start creating those connections they wouldn't have otherwise, right? Students in their first year had someone who genuinely cared and that was there for them, right? I can't begin to tell you the countless of stories of that I know, right? Because I'm on the other end and I hear those stories, right? Of first year students who would have not gotten through their first year because they had that constant, that peer mentor who they could turn to, who had the map, who had the keys, right? Who knew how to navigate, who provided the advice, who provided them with a network, who provided them with information of where to go and when to go, right? Someone they trusted, and they continue to trust long after that first year. It comes down to that individual level relationships that we oftentimes lose in the law school space because of the high pressure, the elitism, the demand for performance. It comes down to that human connection and how do you connect that one to the other. And so that holistic institutional transformation, right, does come down to how those connections happen and what happens in those connections, right, that build off of each other, that at the end of the day, a law student makes it through their first year because they weren't alone.
I think those are really great questions for students to ask a school when they're trying to make a decision for themselves. Where will there be a space that I will feel that I can really thrive and be at my best? What kind of mentorship do you have? What do your student organizations look like in your affinity groups? What is the community piece of it? And to the extent that students can get to know that information, I think it really does support them finding schools that will be the right fit for them. And to the extent that schools start to see that that is a true value that is determinative for a lot of students of where they'll go, it puts more pressure to kind of create that environment. Liz, as we start to sort of wrap this up and move forward, I want to talk about shaping the future. So the report paints a picture of what motivates future legal minds. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about what role you believe schools should play in shaping the legal leaders that we're going to see tomorrow and really trying to respond better to the motivations that students have for coming to law school in the first place.
So, my humble opinion, law schools play a large role in shaping the legal leaders of tomorrow, right? Beyond just teaching us how to think like a lawyer, who we are, our experiences, how we interact, engage, and collaborate with others, including those different from us, right? Are key to who we become as legal leaders and who we are as a profession generally. So, how we practice law should be incorporated, the how part, right? Be incorporated in legal education. So for many, some might read, that's a focus on professional identity formation. For others, it's about teaching law outside of the usual vacuum and into the experiential space, which we'd already talked about. Because holding your client's hand on one of their worst days ever, or learning how to de-escalate a conflict, are experiences that transform us in law school, right? Because law lives beyond the pages of our textbooks. And our respondents in this report echo this in telling us why they want to go to law school and what kind of environment they expect there.
Liz, as we start to look ahead, I want to talk about, I guess, what's next for the research that you're doing. You mentioned a little bit of a teaser into what some of the data that you're working on now looks like. But this is the first, the Knowledge Report is the first in a series of reports. And so, what can we expect next? And what areas do you feel still need more exploration? And how do you hope the report is going to shift the conversation about legal education moving forward?
All areas need to be explored. With our new applied research team, which includes Annie Rushen, Deb Langer, Alicia Kirchhoff, we're currently focused on understanding the different points along that pre-law through practice journey, both at the aggregate view, so think of the bird's eye view, right? and on the ground, so that's how specific groups at specific points in time are experiencing the journey. And so, as you said, this is our first report focused on test takers and prospective applicants. We'll be coming out with our next report focused on the 2023-10 profile, which dives into the 23 first-year class and how they made their decision as to where to enroll, right? And you'll see that the factors you considered when deciding where to apply versus where to enroll, once you have, you know, all the letters in front of you of whether or not you've gotten in or not, right? How you make that decision is different. And so there's a lot to weigh in such a big decision as to where you're gonna go to law school. And the 23-10 class told us that they weighed what they weighed when they made their enrollment decision and what they would weigh now would actually be pretty different. So we're excited for that report to come out. The team has a few more reports coming out, mapping the journey, exploring trends and admissions and the 1L class and what that looks like and what people are thinking, feeling, and doing. So there's a lot more to stay tuned for. As far as the legal landscape, right? And I think this is one of the major themes kind of coming out of this conversation is that in legal education, we are a community, right? Consisting of different stakeholders, pre-law advisors, pathway programs, law schools. And so if we are one of them, right? If you listeners out there are one of them and you're interested in working with us in some way or another, right? Please feel free to reach out. Let me know. Because at the end of the day, what I'm hoping is that this work will result in more collaboration and impact, Max. Real change is seen when we come together to effectively support access, equity, and fairness, right? Access to the legal profession starts long before admissions, and it continues long after. And so with this first report, what I also truly, truly hope that we did with the 23 and 24 test taker experience, that we did it justice. I hope their voices echo throughout the landscape as we continue recruiting, supporting, teaching, revolutionizing, welcoming the next generation of legal leaders.
And we'll link to the full report in the description of this episode. But Liz, how can folks stay in touch with you?
It's ebodimer@lsac.org.
Well, there you have it. Elizabeth Bodimer is the Director of Research Strategy at the Law School Admissions Council. LSAC's 2024 Knowledge Report is out now. I encourage everyone to go and read it. Liz, this has been a really enriching conversation and a fun one for me. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing to inform all of us about what people are thinking. And thank you for joining me on the DEI podcast.
Thank you.
The Welcome Table podcast at Notre Dame Law School is produced by Notre Dame Studios. Every episode, we sit down with key voices in law, culture, society, and business to explore issues that shape our world. If you enjoyed today's conversation, subscribe to stay updated on new episodes, and tune in next time for another thoughtful conversation on issues that touch us all. Until then, take care.